Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in as we continue to pour through the piles of baseball cards from my personal collection. We've been doing this for more than a year now, believe it or not. Yes, the show that I thought would last just 5 weeks. We've managed to do it for 13 or 14 months now, and I'm so grateful for everybody who's kept this show going. And I'm glad that we're able to dive back into the big old monster box for a little bit. Some good memories coming up with some of these cards, primarily from the 1980s. And we've got a good one. Well, a good player, not necessarily a good card. I thought Fleer got an A for effort in 1981, but there's a lot of flaws with this set. But not too many flaws with our random pull. Card number 316, the Italian Stallion, Lee Mazzilli. And he even looks like a movie star in this picture here. You've got the white fluffy clouds in the background. He's got the movie star looks, the Sly Stallone sheepish Italian grin here in this photograph. It looks like a movie poster from the 1950s. Could be a little John Wayne, could be a little James Dean, but we will talk about the literal movie star, although that's not what he's best known for, but a guy who was brought into a very, very, very desperate situation in the New York Mets in the mid-1970s, a Brooklyn native who was compared to some of the greatest baseball players, not just in New York baseball history, but of all time. And did he live up to those expectations? On the whole, no. But he did help the Mets win a World Series. That's what he was drafted for, although it came about not quite necessarily in a way that a lot of people thought it would. It did, because all the pieces came together at the right time. And for Lee Mazzilli, timing was everything when the Mets won the World Series in 1986. So we'll talk about his career in just a little bit. We'll also talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And we'll dive into 81 Fleer as well. In fact, let's do that very briefly before we talk about Mazzilli, because there's actually quite a bit of storylines that come from Lee Mazzilli. But 81 Fleer, the history of Fleer getting into the baseball card industry in 1981 is well known now, and I'm not going to go through the entire history again. I would just encourage you to go back a few episodes, listen to the 1980 Tops episode featuring random poll Len Barker. We did that a few weeks ago, and I lay out the entire history of how Fleer got back into the business. You know, they dabbled with baseball cards in the late 50s, put out a set in 1963 that Topps very quickly squashed through legal maneuvers. And starting in 1974, Fleer started a lawsuit that slowly weaved its way through the court system. By the late 70s, Topps knew that they were probably not going to win that battle. Fleer had put together a very compelling argument that Topps and the Major League Baseball Players Association, not necessarily working hand in hand in like a true collusion sense, but with separate deals, basically, I'll put it this way, unwittingly worked together to create a monopoly in the baseball card market, where Topps cornered the market single-handedly for 25 years. Well, Fleer won that battle, but they didn't know they would win that battle until the summer of 1980. And the deal was, at the end of 1980, in fact, January 1st, 1981, the Players Association had to offer Fleer a right of first refusal to create a recognized set of baseball cards, a true competitor to Topps. And the Players Association could also offer that license to other companies, and that's how Donruss was created in 1981. And naturally, because Fleer had been battling in court for 6 years for this opportunity, they said, yeah. But Fleer had several things working against them. First of all, because Topps cornered the market for 25 years, Fleer had to start from square one, and they had to start from square one and launch a brand new product in large quantity just to try to reach the scale that Topps had reached over decades of dominance. So they were always behind the eight ball, as was Donruss. But also, Fleer and Donruss had the same problem with quality of cards, not just the designs, not just the card stock, which was always an issue with Fleer and Donruss in the early days. Less of an issue for Fleer, certainly for Donruss. They had a very flimsy card stock. But photography, and I've mentioned this before, and again, the 1980 Topps podcast really dives into this. Also, our first podcast on 81 Fleer, that was our second episode on a random pull Larry Cox of the Seattle Mariners, then the late Larry Cox. We dived into it just a little bit. So if you listen to those two archive episodes, you'll get the complete story of how Fleer came about and some of the challenges they had. And this is where I give the quick plug for our platforms, our archive sites. You know, the new episodes are released via Audioboom, but we also link them up to iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Blueberry. So you not only get the new episodes, but also the archived episodes. So the episode on 80 Topps, Len Barker, again, it's only four or five episodes ago. And then the episode number two is the one that was our first look at 81 Fleer. So check those out at your convenience. Now, we will talk a little bit about the design of 81 Fleer because, as I mentioned at the start of the show, I give it an A for effort. You know, they really tried to come up with a decent product. And again, they had to create something quickly in large quantities. They had to try to reach the scale of Topps. And because Topps had worked the angle with so many, first of all, wholesalers, you know, grocery stores, drug stores, candy shops, and then you had individual hobby shops, and you also had, you know, those third-party groups that would take the old product and repackage it in new, you know, variety packs and stuff like that. Topps had worked so many angles. They were able to penetrate the market so much easier than Fleer. Fleer not only had to create a product from square one, they had to create a marketing team and a sales team. And it was a bit of a challenge for them. And again, Donruss had to face the same challenges early on. But I think when it comes to the general design of 81 Fleer, it's okay. It's not terrible, but it's certainly nothing that you know, really clamor for. Now, because it was the first edition of the officially licensed product, the 81 Fleer set, and because in general products, not just Fleer, but Donruss and Topps from 1981, it is a 36-year-old set. They're in demand. You can still find 81 Fleer quite readily. You know, it's certainly not, you know, flooding the market, but you could still find boxes and wax packs. You can find them for decent prices. I've seen boxes nowadays going for anywhere, and again, it just depends on where you're buying them from, anywhere from $35 to about $50, $60. And, you know, packs you can get for a couple dollars a piece. Certainly the price has spiked in the last few years. I remember about 15, actually a little longer than that, 17 or 18 years ago, I bought a box of 81 Fleer off eBay. eBay was still kind of a new thing then, and I think it was about $30 for that. So the price has gone up, but you can still get it. It's still in demand, despite its flaws, and we'll get into those in just a moment. It's still a popular set, not only because that is the premier edition of the recognized, officially licensed set that Fleer produced, but also there's enough cards on the market to where it's still affordable to collect them, but the market is not saturated. This is not junk wax era numbers, you know, like 91 Fleer would be. 81 Fleer, there's still enough out there, but not too much. So the player cards, the star cards, the rookie cards, you know, you're looking at the Harold Baines card, Ricky Henderson, that would be his second year card, although his first Fleer card. Player cards for George Brett and Robin Yount and Carlton Fisk and other players who, you know, became stars in the 70s, they still carry some value. Pete Rose was really leveraged. In fact, he's featured on the box top of many of the Fleer boxes. So you've got plenty of Pete Rose cards in there, Reggie Jackson, you name it. There's a lot of star power here, and because it's the premier edition and because you've got some pretty big names, 81 Fleer still does carry some weight, again, despite the flaws. And let's pick some of those flaws out as we look at the Lee Mazzilli card here. Now, again, Fleer kept it very simple in 1981. You could see there's plenty of white border. You've got this inside border, this kind of rounded border that was color coordinated for different teams. For the Mets, you had this orange border. You would see the same color for the Houston Astros. Other teams like the Pirates would have a yellow border. The Indians had kind of this pink border. The Blue Jays, Royals, you know, they had this blue border. So there was a little bit of color coordination here, and it actually plays off very well. At the bottom, you've got a little space for the player's name and position in this yellow space. You've got this big baseball in the lower left-hand corner with the team name kind of written on there in Sharpie marker, as I've noted before. It does look like team names are autographed onto the baseball, and I don't think that was by plan. I just don't think Fleer really had a plan to incorporate logos. And because of the tight time squeeze, again, they found out in July of 1980 they could do this. They get the permission officially granted in January of 1981. Well, they've got to get product in the street by late February. So I think that's one reason why they bypassed all the logos. They couldn't actually get their hands on them until January. And, you know, nowadays you could turn around a baseball card in just a few hours with certain, you know, graphic software with, you know, Adobe Photoshop and stuff like that. You know, this is 1981. Manufacturing was still a little primitive compared to today's technique. So Fleer basically had about 6 weeks to turn around a complete 660 card set. So they did leave some elements by the wayside, including logos. You don't see any team logos on the front or the backs of these cards. Now, what you do see on the front of the cards is outdated photography. Even though this Mazzilli picture, like I said, it does have this 1950s movie poster quality to it. That would be one of the few exceptions in the 81 Fleer set. They typically had to collect from freelance photographers, or, you know, they would send out a photographer because, like I said, Fleer knew that the day would come where they could actually use some of these photographs for baseball cards. But a lot of the pictures were 3 or 4 years old. So you will see players wearing uniforms that are outdated. Best examples are pictures of players for the San Diego Padres in the 81 Fleer set. The Padres used to change their uniform pretty much every season in the mid to late 70s. First, they would do variables of the road uniform, and then starting in 78, they changed their uniform every time and finally settled on a design in 1981, one that they would wear through the 1984 season. But if you look at pictures of Padres in the 81 Fleer set, the pictures are all from 1978. And you can tell this not only because of the jersey design, but also because of the all-star patch that is featured on the sleeve of the 78 team uniform. The Padres hosted the all-star game in 78, so you have this patch on there. And it throws things off here. Here it is, it's 1981, and they're using pictures from 3 years before. A lot of the pictures, too, were kind of grainy. You had this kind of cheesecloth effect on them. They also were not very well lit. They were taken in many of them, not all of them, but many of them were taken either on cloudy days at a stadium or in a dark, dingy kind of stadium. I mentioned on the Larry Cox podcast, episode number 2, I thought that picture was taken in Fenway Park and probably taken on an April morning in Fenway Park. So it's kind of cloudy and dreary and the stadium is dark. And, you know, the Mariners then had kind of this, they didn't really have the powder blue. They had a little darker blue road uniform. So, you know, everything kind of plays off rather dark. You had a lot of contrast issues with photography in 81 Fleer. So you didn't have really good pictures for the most part in this set. Again, the Mazzilli one is definitely different from the rest of the set, but that was something that really hampered Fleer and certainly Donruss in the early 1980s. Now let's flip the card over. One thing I like about 81 Fleer is the color combination and the just the overall presentation of the card. They kept it very simple, and again, out of necessity, they had to, but I think they put together a decent package of stats, of information, of design. You've got this kind of silver border on the outside, a gold inner border, and then on a white background, you've got the black text here. You've got the card number in the upper left-hand corner. His career major league average in the right-hand corner. For pitchers, it would be a career major league earned run average. And I thought that was a neat way of just parsing out some of the stats here. It is a little redundant, though, because if you just go to the bottom of the card in the career stats, you can find the career average. Fleer would rectify that in 1982, even though the 82 Fleer set is one of the worst in Fleer history and baseball card history, in my opinion. You still have the introduction of team logos in the 82 Fleer set, although strangely, they put the logo on the back of the card and not the front. The front really could have used it in 82, but basically where the career batting average or earned run average is in the upper right-hand corner of the 81 set, that's where you would find the logo in the 82 set. Now, it's also interesting when you look at how baseball cards competed with one another in 1981, other than all three brands trying to stuff some terrible-tasting bubblegum inside their card packs, was how they treated the design. And you can pan all three of them for how the fronts of the cards looked. But the backs of the cards, it's an interesting approach. You know, Topps, they just stayed with what worked. They had stats, they had little cartoons, little trivial tidbits, the gray card stock, nothing out of the ordinary. Basically, what Topps had done in the previous 10 years, it was on the back of the 81 set. Donruss, even though it's a little clunky, I thought it was very original, didn't do the full stats. They did the written timeline, which, you know, now you can't really do. You know, people are just so used to short sound bites, short snippets of information, lots of stats, numbers, data. But 81 Donruss, and this was the only time they did it, instead of showing just a litany of stats, they would, write out highlights. So you would have a career timeline on the back of the cards. While Fleer, like I said, kept it very simple. And basically, took the Topps formula and simplified it. No trivia, no cartoons, no interesting little notes about the player's career. It's the Joe Friday approach, just the facts, ma'am. That's all you have on here, just numbers. And again, I think because of the color combinations, it does kind of work. And it's a unique look that nobody else ever really tried, certainly not in the 80s and certainly not before then or afterwards, going with the gray, silver, and white back. The cardstock for Fleer was a thick white cardstock. That was a departure from what Topps had done. In fact, Topps had not used white cardstock since 1970. And sometimes the color combinations on a gray cardstock would work for Topps. Other times, not so much. I think it worked well in 81. But Fleer was able to look a little sharper and a little more crisper because of the white cardstock. Now, that doesn't mean the cardstock did not have its problems. One main problem with the cardstock is over time, the cardstock would bow. That is, it would just kind of very slowly, bend a little bit. And if you've ever gone through a box of 81 Fleer cards, like if you get a wax box and you rip open all the packs and you try to put together a set, you'll notice that there is a little bit of a curvature to the card. And for some card sets, that's true over time. It has a lot to do with packaging. I think it was just how 81 Fleer was manufactured. So you do have this little bowing of the cards. You can resolve that if you take a stack of these cards and put something heavy on top of it, like a big book or a brick or something like that. It will eventually straighten itself out, but that is a bit of a problem. Also, the cardstock, while it wasn't a rough cut, you do have a little roughness to the edges here. So even though a card would come fresh out of a pack, you have these little specks of cardboard kind of hanging off the edges here. And that certainly made for a less than perfect card. You're sitting there, if you've got that big rookie card or star card, you're basically kind of with your fingernail trying to very lightly, chip these little cardboard tags off the edges of the cards. So that got to be a little bit of a problem there. But again, 81 Fleer, I give an A for effort. I like some of the things they did. They had to keep it very simple just because of the time crunch. But overall, this is not a card where you go, wow, it's 81 Fleer. It's just not. Didn't really have that appeal back then. Doesn't have that appeal now. And I've heard this from several listeners of our shows because the Fleer brand, again, had to work really hard to get product penetration into the market where Topps had the corner for years and years and years. A lot of people weren't even exposed to Fleer cards in 1981. You weren't exposed to them until maybe the mid to late 80s. And because you didn't experience that exposure, you have really no desire to collect it. So 81 Fleer does have some desire in the sense, again, that it's a premier edition and there are plenty of stars and decent young players in it. But because of all the challenges that it had to face, with a short time to turn around and make a product, but also because the design was rather generic for the most part, it's a set that is not necessarily, like I said, clamored for. There are good players there. It's not a bad set to put together on your own, but this is not one of those great sets from the 70s that we've talked about. Or, as we would see later in the decade, it's not an 83 or an 87 Topps. It's not an 84 Fleer. It's the first, and it certainly had its little issues, but not the best. And that means that there's still some product out there because it's not so in demand. So you could still find it, again, at rather affordable prices when comparing to other product from around the same time. Now, Fleer would really stumble out of the gate with 82. As I mentioned, just one of my least favorite sets of all time. But they would get their act together in 83. The design was better. The cardstock, still white, but a better quality, a little stiffer than what you saw in 81. And also innovative. Fleer really got creative by putting the picture on the back of a card. Granted, it was a small black and white photo, but that was something Topps hadn't done since 1971. Topps wouldn't do that until 1993, at least putting player pictures on the back. In 1992, Topps would put pictures of the stadiums on the back. But, Fleer was a little ahead of the curve by coming up with this innovation, and they would put the pictures of the players on the backs of the cards through 1985. And Fleer started a string of very successful sets starting in 83 and moving on, in my opinion, through 1990. They had a couple sets in between there that were kind of eh, but overall they had a very successful run up until the fateful Banana Peel set of 1991. And after that, it was kind of all downhill. Of course, the same could be said for much of the industry back then. Much could be said for Lee Mazzilli as well, as this kid came into Major League Baseball at a very, very young age. He was a regular player for the Mets at the age of 22, and he was introduced to baseball in a very, very unfair fashion. A hometown kid who was compared to some of the greatest players of all time, and just thrown into the fire as the Mets were trying to undo the many messes that they created in the mid-70s and tried to start rebuilding into a winning team, which, as I said, eventually did happen in 1986, and Mazzilli was part of that, but certainly not in the route that he thought he would go on, from being a first-round draft pick in 1973 to being a world champion in 1986. And even though Mazzilli faced a lot of pressures of playing in New York, playing in his hometown, he was a Brooklyn native, and being compared to Willie Mays and Duke Snider and Mickey Mantle. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the holy trinity of outfielders in New York baseball history, but also his batting prowess compared to Pete Rose. You know, Rose was in his prime in the late 70s when Mazzilli was making his major league debut. Even though he had to face all these pressures, Mazzilli didn't seem to mind. In fact, he took the fame and certainly the fortune all within stride. And that's not to say that he didn't have any sleepless nights or some rough games, but overall, I think he handled things rather well. It was almost like this was a match made in heaven for him. As Mazzilli, again, born in Brooklyn, the son of a former boxer, so he had athleticism built into the family genes. Believe it or not, Lee Mazzilli may not have been a Major League Baseball player. He was a dual sport athlete. Now, we've talked before about dual sport athletes, many players who came of age in the 70s and played in the 80s. Their dual sport actually was baseball and basketball. You didn't have the baseball and football combo until the late 80s, thanks mostly to Bo Jackson, but of course, Deion Sanders. You had other guys like DJ Dozier, Brian Jordan, you know, who didn't quite live up to the fame of Bo and Deion. But for Lee Mazzilli, it wasn't basketball, it wasn't football, it wasn't track and field. He was a championship speed skater. In fact, he was one of the best speed skaters in America in the late 60s and early 70s. And while Olympic Games now are very lucrative for Olympic athletes once they're done with the Olympics and their eligibility is up, in the early 70s, that wasn't really the case. You know, baseball was still in America the number one sport. And if you were gifted enough to be able to play the sport of baseball, that was the sport that you focused on. And that's what Lee Mazzilli did. And it worked out rather well for him. So he was built physically for speed skating. So he had a really muscular body, you know, an Olympic athlete's body. And he was also gifted in not only being able to hit a baseball real well, but he was also naturally ambidextrous. And throughout his high school years, he would actually bring two gloves to the ball field. He could throw right-handed or left-handed, and he could do both rather well. Now, he didn't really have a cannon of an arm, but he was talented enough to where whatever position you put him in, if he needed to be a lefty or a righty, he could do that. So that caught the attention of some people in the early 70s, including a cashier at a brokerage firm of M. Donald Grant. Grant, at the time, in the early 70s, was the owner of the New York Mets. So this cashier says, "Hey, I know somebody who knows somebody who knows this kid who's, you know, ambidextrous, pretty good hitter, a local kid too." So, you know, Mets scouts had their eyes on Lee Mazzilli very early on, not just because he was literally in their backyard in Brooklyn, but, you know, they got a little insider information that, hey, you better take a second look at this kid. And ultimately, the Mets draft him 14th overall in the 1973 draft. And this is something that we talked about in the 1980 Tops podcast on Len Barker. This was the draft where the Texas Rangers had the first draft pick and famously took David Clyde first overall, and they very quickly threw him out in the major league field and he blew his arm out. This was the draft where they could have selected Robin Yount or Dave Winfield, which the Brewers and Padres did just a couple of picks later. Well, Mazzilli was around in the 14th selection. The Mets pick him there. And that was a draft that is not known for its heavy hitters outside of Yount and Winfield. Eddie Murray was taken in the third round by Baltimore. But Mazzilli was able to stand out again as a star player, not just because he was the local kid, but he really had some incredible talent. And he moved up through the Mets farm system very quickly, not only because statistically he put up the numbers, but again, the Mets were on the downside. They were starting to fall apart. There were all sorts of issues within the locker room. Players didn't like what management was doing. The management was just tired of what was going on the field, so they decided to just blow the team up and start building, from within with good draft picks and some young prospects. So, he was fast-tracked, Lee Mazzilli was. Made his debut in 1976, had a few key hits and key games, even though the Mets were well out of contention. They were playing the role of spoiler rather well, in fact, dimming the Pittsburgh Pirates' chances of getting into the playoffs. The Pirates are chipping away at the Phillies, leading the National League East, and Mazzilli would have a walk-off home run late in the 76 season for the Mets. That really put a dent in the Pirates' playoff hopes, as the case would be. So he made a name for himself early on, and then in 1977, the Mets just decided, okay, we're not going to deal with any of these veteran players. We're just going to throw the kids out there, and Lee Mazzilli was one of them. Now, not only was Mazzilli a very talented player, he was a very attractive young man, and you look at him. He's very handsome. I mean, this is a guy who had the movie star looks. And keep in mind, too, in 1977, this is right around the time, speaking of unfair comparisons, John Travolta was becoming a star, first through the TV show Welcome Back, Kotter, but then about a year later through the release of the film Saturday Night Fever. So even though Mazzilli and Travolta weren't necessarily, comparing apples to apples here, you had the same, young Italian, born guy who, just has this kind of aura, this bravado around him. And he shared that not only with Travolta, but with Sylvester Stallone, too. The Rocky movie had just come out. So, there's this just kind of desire, this fandom for Italian-American, if not American, Italian-American born movie stars, the characters that they portray, whether it was Rocky Balboa or Vinnie Barbarino, a guy like Lee Mazzilli, all right, he looked good to begin with, but then he had these Hollywood types that people were comparing him to as well. So he very quickly became a star in New York, not only because this was the great hope of the Mets that they were going to build around to create a world champion, but also this guy just looked really good. He played the part well, and like I said, he ate up the attention. He absolutely loved it. 1979 was by far the best season for Lee Mazzilli, as he put up statistically one of his best years, appearing in 158 games, also hitting 15 home runs. He wasn't known for his power. He was more of a consistent hitter. In fact, hit 303 in the 79 season. That was his lone All-Star season. He was the lone representative of the Mets in the 79 All-Star game in Seattle. And even though Dave Parker takes the MVP award in that game, and there's still that great clip of Parker gunning down a runner, trying to get from third to home. And, this is Parker, no hop, just a solid rope of a throw, good 320 feet from right field at the Kingdome. Lee Mazzilli had a couple of key defensive plays and also had a big hit and a bases-loaded walk to help the National League win that game. So Dave Parker gets all the highlights, but Lee Mazzilli was a big part of that National League win in 1979 as well. Now, after that, he continues to star in New York, but he starts battling some injuries in 1981. He starts having some issues at the plate, and he's not quite coming through. Like I said, he was a consistent hitter, but the Mets need just a little more. Also, the Mets kind of created a little bit of a problem by really heaping on Mazzilli this idea that he should give up the whole ambidextrous thing and throw right-handed. Now, like I said, he didn't necessarily have a major league arm right or left. He was just adequate at throwing with both hands. But they said, we can use you more if you throw right-handed. Well, a young outfielder, Mookie Wilson, is coming up through the Mets system. So now they need to move Mazzilli somewhere else. So they start experimenting with him at first base. Well, he had given up throwing with his left hand, so he's the rare right-handed first baseman. and it's not working out so well. They move him back out into the outfield, but then the Mets acquire George Foster, who was still in his prime then, and now they have no place to put Lee Mazzilli. So they promptly trade him to the Texas Rangers. Now, the Rangers were a little bit on the downslide as well, and the Mets, in return, got a couple of young pitchers that you didn't really know much about at the time. And this happened right before the start of the 82 season. But this would be the first of two trades involving Lee Mazzilli, or players acquired for Lee Mazzilli, that would help plant the seeds for the 86 World Champion Mets. In this trade to Texas, the Mets acquired pitchers Walt Terrell and Ron Darling. Of course, Darling, the starter of many crucial games for the Mets in 86, including Game 7 against the Boston Red Sox. So you didn't know then, but that would be a key part. The other player involved in that deal, Walt Terrell, would be traded to Detroit after the 1984 season for a primarily third baseman, but all-around good hitting utility infielder by the name of Howard Johnson. Hojo, another big part of that championship Mets team in 1986. Now, things aren't going well for Lee Mazzilli in Texas in 1982, again, dealing with injuries, manages to play a grand total of 58 games for the Rangers, hitting only .241. The Rangers, again, kind of on the downturn, so they decide to move him. In August of 82, they trade him to the Yankees for Bucky Dent, another, you know, young movie star, popular player in New York. So he goes to the Yankees for a little bit and spends a very brief time for a Yankees team, which is also starting to be on the downturn a little bit and needing to turn things around. Appears in only 37 games for the Yankees, hitting .266 along the way. And after the 82 season, he is on the move once again to Pittsburgh for a couple of, three career minor leaguers, Jerry Oban, Jose Rivera, and Bubba Holland, and also Tim Burke. Burke actually had a fairly decent major league career, but he's basically moved for spare parts in 1982. In Pittsburgh, he has some pretty decent years. Again, not complete seasons, as he's dealing with injuries again throughout the mid-1980s, but was serviceable defensively, was fairly consistent offensively. I'd say he'd average about .260 at the plate in his time in Pittsburgh. But he was more known for what happened off the field. He testified in the Pittsburgh drug trials, which became public knowledge in 1985. He was not punished by Peter Uberoth, the commissioner of Major League Baseball at the time. There's all sorts of innuendo about, well, what did he do? What did he know about these drug dealers who were being prosecuted in Pittsburgh? And that really put a dark cloud over his career at the time. So unfortunately, that would linger around with him for a while. And his time in Pittsburgh, too, was not very positive for Mazzilli. And it's not only because of the Pittsburgh drug trials, but also the Pirates are going through rebuilding at the time. Eventually, they build up into a pretty good team in the late 80s and early 90s. But they're at the bottom again in the mid-80s. He didn't feel like he was really being appreciated. There are all sorts of rumors that the Mets wanted to reacquire him in a veteran kind of pinch role. Because, you know, at this time, he's, you know, crossing over the 30-year-old barrier here. And depending on which report you read, the Mets reportedly offered to trade Ray Knight for Lee Mazzilli. The Pirates reportedly turned down that trade. And again, you know, just amazing how the pieces all come together here. Had the Mets been able to pull that trade off, Ray Knight, who had some key games in 1986 for the Mets, well, that would have been removed from the equation. So I don't know if the Mets win a World Series in 1986. Maybe they do, as Mazzilli would have been, you know, used in more of a productive role, but Knight really came through with some big hits, especially in that series. So that's one of those great what ifs in baseball there. What if the Mets actually traded Ray Knight for Lee Mazzilli? Would they have won a World Series in 86? I don't know. It's just an interesting question to ponder. But the deal falls through, and Mazzilli's time in Pittsburgh falls through as well. They eventually release him in July of 1986. So now the Mets have their chance. They still see a role for Mazzilli. They sign him as a free agent in 1986, send him down to Tidewater, and ironically, it's George Foster, the guy who, being acquired by the Mets, kind of pushed Mazzilli out in 1982. Well, the Mets decide to cut ties with Foster in 86. So after just a few days in Tidewater, Mazzilli goes up to New York and he stays with the Mets and is part of that World Championship team. Didn't really make a mark in the 86 NLCS against Houston, but had some big rally-inducing hits and plays in the World Series against Boston. So finally, Mazzilli does come through as potential promised back in 1973 and when he was making his debut in 1976. Yes, Lee Mazzilli did deliver a World Series for the New York Mets, but not quite in the fashion that you would think he would. Now, Mazzilli was also part of the Mets in 87 and 88. Again, pretty much relegated to a platoon and pinch hitting, pinch running situation. In 1988, he was part of the Mets team that made it to the playoffs and then lost to the eventual world champion Dodgers. And in 1989, he was cut loose by the Mets. He was waived by them. The Toronto Blue Jays pick him up in a pennant race, and Mazzilli will provide some key hits in a big series between Toronto and Baltimore late in the 1989 season that helped the Blue Jays seal the American League East Division title that year. So his career wraps up after 1989, as nobody wanted to pick him up after the Blue Jays waive him, or release him, I should say. They didn't waive him. They just cut him loose after the 89 season. So his career comes to an end on the field, but off the field, he gets into acting, and in fact, he had the occasional bit parts when he was a ball player, but he didn't want acting to interfere with his baseball career. But he got into plays, off-Broadway plays. He appeared in several TV shows in the early 90s, got back into the swing of things in the managerial profession under the tutelage of Joe Torre. Torre was his manager with the Mets, another Brooklyn-born Italian-American, so they had a great synergy with one another. Well, with Torre being the manager of the New York Yankees in the mid-90s, after Buck Showalter, Torre wanted Mazzilli to be a manager in the Yankee system. So he was the manager of the Tampa Yankees in 1997 and 98, moved up through the Yankee system, and was part of Torre's team of coaches in the early 2000s. And Mazzilli would get his chance to manage the Baltimore Orioles in 2004, had a respectable 78-84 record. Remember, the Orioles were pretty bad in the early 2000s, but he got them to a third place finish in 2004. The O's had a great start in 2005, but then hit the skids, had just a terrible summer. We're dealing with the dark clouds of, you know, rumored steroid usage with Rafael Palmeiro and Sammy Sosa. Sosa was with the Orioles then. So, you know, a lot of tainted individual performances kind of tainted the season for the Orioles as well. And finally, he got cut loose in August of 2005. Sam Perlazzo would take over as the manager of the Orioles. And since then, Mazzilli has not gotten into management. He has, again, done some coaching. He's done some acting. He's done some broadcasting as well. And right now, he is a mentor to Lee Mazzilli Jr., who you may know as LJ Mazzilli, who was drafted by, you guessed it, the New York Mets. And LJ Mazzilli was smoking his way up through the Mets farm system, and unfortunately, quite literally, smoking his way up, as he was suspended a couple times, once for 50 games for drug abuse. And this was not, by all indications, a performance-enhancing drug. This is something illegal. This, and there were no details on exactly what he was using, but it was a controlled substance, which he did go through therapy for, and was able to kind of right himself again. But he is still in the Mets farm system this season, going between Hartford, and Las Vegas, so between AA and AAA. At the age of 26, though, you would have to think that LJ Mazzilli's chances of getting to the big leagues, this is about the time where you have to fish or cut bait. So hopefully Lee Mazzilli Jr., LJ Mazzilli, stays clean. Hopefully he's gotten that out of his system, and hopefully he does get a chance to make it to the major leagues. So there you go, the career of random pull Lee Mazzilli, card number 316 in the 81 Fleer set. Like I said, the Italian stallion, the Italian lover, as his pin in his locker used to say, according to one story, a guy who had incredible talents, also some incredibly good looks. He was a fan favorite. The ladies loved him in New York, especially in the late 70s. Clothes makers loved him too, because he tended to wear uniforms that were a size too short so he could show off those speed skating thighs of his. And Mets fans would eventually love him too, as the long circuitous route from first round draft selection in 1973 to world champion was completed in 1986 by way of the Mets, Rangers, Yankees, Pirates, and Mets once again. And a lot of, like I said, incredible just how the planets and stars aligned for Mazzilli and the Mets. You know, the Ray Knight trade, that didn't happen. Mazzilli getting traded for Walt Terrell and Ron Darling. Terrell getting traded for Howard Johnson. You know, all these pieces that just came together just right in 86. And even though, you know, statistically, Mazzilli did not live up to the comparisons to Rose and Mays and Mantle and Snyder, still he was able to live up to the expectations of delivering a championship for his hometown, which is very, very cool. And by the way, I should throw this in. Mazzilli's favorite player growing up was Willie Mays. He emulated Willie Mays, made a lot of basket catches like Willie Mays, and shortly after getting drafted by the Mets, was able to meet Willie Mays. As you know, Mays, his career was pretty much winding down with the Mets in 1973. So I think that's a nice little tag to the story of Lee Mazzilli and his hero, the Say Hey Kid, Willie Mays. So let's see what you're saying, Say Hey, at our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, as we wrap up our show here with a couple of interesting observations. The last podcast we did, we looked at Glenn Hubbard and the 86 Topps set, which is not one of my favorites, but some people still like it. Again, you know, especially with context, if you look at 83 through 87, Topps had some of their best and most memorable sets then, and 86 is kind of the lowest hanging fruit there. As I put it in the show, if I gave you a vending box of each 83, 84, 85, 86, and 87 Topps, I guarantee you, I promise you, I know that the 86 Topps box is the last one you open. If you open it, you're ripping through 83 and 87 and 85 and 84 before you're doing 86. In fact, you may just put it back in a box somewhere and get around to it one of these days. But, you know, we do have some fans that, you know, like the overall look. As Peter Steinberg chimes in, I'm a fan of 86, even though it's not spectacular. I like the design. Photography, of course, wanting, and he attaches a picture of Willie McGee, and Willie always had this look like, you know, somebody farted on his living room couch, and that is never more present than the 86 Topps card. But 86 Topps photography, good but not great, much like the overall design. Now, we had an interesting conversation that was started by Tony. Tony L, as he mentions, I feel like this design is one that looks better on the white cardstock used now, just as the 87 design looks better on gray cardboard. In fact, Peter Steinberg responded, there was a 2012 Topps Archives card with Daryl Strawberry, and it's the 86 design, but it is on white cardstock, which, of course, Topps has been using ever since 1992. And I absolutely agree, and if you want to look at 86 Topps on white cardstock, all you have to do is look at the Topps traded sets. And I like the comparison, too, of 87, where if you look at the 87 Topps traded, especially the backs of the cards. It actually looks like 1970 Topps, you know, same color scheme, different design, but overall same look. And 87 Topps, maybe because it's the wood grain border design, it just looks better on gray cardstock than white cardstock. So we have a pretty interesting conversation going on about the different cardstocks, and not only for 86 and 87, but also subsequent sets. So check that out again at Wax and Gum Stains. Rick Houston calling me on the carpet about 87 Topps. Man, we got to talk about our favorite set designs. You like 87 Topps. I hated them. You hated 75. I love the colors. Well, a correction there, Rick. I actually don't hate 75. 75 is just, it's just one of those, in my opinion, it's there. It's glaring. You can't miss it. It's kind of like that, you know, loud neon yellow t-shirt that we all had in 1990. You know, it's just, it's there. It's not necessarily bad, but you can't miss it. You know where it is when the lights are out. And I actually like 75 Topps because it is so representative of the time. And, you know, color TV coming out in full blast then with, you know, actually making teams come up with different color combinations and bright colors to stand out on TV. So I'm not opposed to 75 Topps. I just don't, you know, again, and this is context here, you know, comparing it to some of the more subdued sets before and after, like 73, 74, 76, and 77, 75 is just a little too wild for my taste, but I actually like it. And of course, with the, you know, the big rookie cards of George Brett and Robin Yount in there, amongst others, you know, there are some other notable names that made their rookie appearance in 75 Topps. I don't hate it. I just don't quite put it on the same level as some of the other sets from the 70s. But I do appreciate your comments there. And a very similar thought from our good friend WaxPack916, who's catching up on some episodes, was listening to the 78, 79, and 80 Topps episodes and says, you know, even though I'm not a big fan of them, he likes them, and he's actually in the process of building these sets. 1980 is his birth year, so he's working on that, wants to work on 78 and 79. And again, let me clarify, you know, for I actually like 78. 79 was a little bit of a mystery. It's and again, I state that it's good but not great, and I feel the same for 1980. You know, as I've mentioned in those podcasts, these were just part of the, you know, the ups and downs. You know, you have moments of creative greatness, and then you have this product that comes out for a few years. And Topps did that. And we've gone through the arcs before. They have moments of greatness in the mid-60s, kind of dipped a little bit in the late 60s and going into the 70s, had a great stretch throughout the 1970s, but I think creatively took a dip a little bit. Definitely with 79, although some people will say it started in 77, but, you know, took a dip that took them way down into 1982. But then Topps would have another resurgence in 1983 and had a good stretch throughout the mid 80s. So, you know, I just think it's more. And again, we have the luxury of looking back, you know, at these cards 35, 40 years later, and we're able to say, this one is better than this one because, again, it's all contextual. But I think those cards really do represent the times and the feelings and the motions that baseball was going through and America was going through, you know, especially in the 70s, but you could see it in the 1980s cards as well. So I don't dislike them. In fact, I really like the 78 Topps set. You know, we did a podcast featuring Rand and Paul Mark Fidrich, and, you know, I actually like that because it's simple and it's got that, what was the word that I used there? That sandlot feel. It's got a scrappy feel to it, and I like it. 79 was just clunky, and it's all because Topps got a little nervous because they knew that Fleer was going to eventually win that court battle and come around. But, you know, you've got that connection to 1980, your birth year. That's why you like that set. And I've said it before, that's why I like 77 Topps more than a lot of collectors do. Some people really poo-poo that set. I like it because, you know, it was my birth year. I've got a lot of connections to that year, not only in the hobby, but in the sport of baseball as well. So, you know, I like that set. And as I've said before, and I'll say it again, and you know, I encourage all forms of discussion. You don't have to agree with everything I say. You don't have to disagree with everything that I say. There is no wrong way to collect baseball cards. There just isn't. And that's the amazing thing about this hobby is that, you know, whether you collect now or you collected a lot more as a kid, you collected in a way that fit you. You know, maybe you liked newer cards versus older cards or vice versa. Maybe you liked collecting by buying packs and boxes of packs as opposed to just buying the complete set or, you know, going to card shows and picking out individual cards. Maybe you're a fan of rookies. Maybe you're a fan of Hall of Famers. Maybe you're a fan of just oddball baseball cards. There's no wrong way to collect them. And I think that's one of the beauties of this hobby here. So we encourage the discussion at Wax and Gum Stains, not only about our podcast and our thoughts about certain sets or players, but your thoughts as well, your methods of collecting. You know, I'm always curious to hear what those were. So check out the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Pass it along to your friends, those who collect now, those who have collected in the past. And don't forget, we've got new episodes every Tuesday at 10 a.m., featuring a look back at some of the baseball cards that you remember, some that you would rather forget as well. Those are available at Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Blueberry. And we also have our Flashback Friday episode, which comes out Friday mornings at 10 o'clock, and we promote it throughout the weekend. This past weekend, we went back and looked back at team sets, and in particular, one bad team. I still have a team set of the 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays, and they were an awful team, but it's a pretty interesting card set, and I've got some fun stories about the Devil Rays, so make sure you catch up on that podcast. And make sure you join us next week, as we're going to change things up just a little bit for this episode. We're going to leave the big old monster box. I got this idea while doing last week's podcast. We're going to talk about jerseys. You know, retro jerseys, they really, really, really hit it big time about 15 years ago. And a big reason why, the hip-hop music industry. You had a lot of rappers who were wearing these throwback uniforms and these oversized throwback uniforms, and that really sparked an already existing industry, but it really got it going again in the early 2000s, and it's still going now. You don't necessarily see it all in music videos, but retro uniforms are still very popular. There's different types, there's different qualities, and they're pretty affordable now. And you're seeing teams going back to a lot of these retro looks. What's old is new again. And part of the reason why teams are, you know, if not on a full-time basis, maybe on Sundays or, you know, the occasional throwback day, they're very willingly going back into the archives and pulling out logos that they buried, pulling out looks that they buried, and they're quite popular. So we're going to talk a little bit about uniforms. I've got a few to share from my own personal collection. Some of them are just really classy-looking throwback Ebbets Field flannels, I should say, minor league jerseys. But some are the late 70s, early 80s major league jerseys that we all grew up with, favorites of mine. I'll share them with you, and I'm definitely looking forward to hearing from you about some of the jerseys that you either have now or maybe you had as a younger person, as a kid, that bring back great memories. And you see a lot of these jerseys on the baseball cards that we look at. You know, if you grew up in New York or you grew up as a Mets fan, you know, what Lee Mazzilli's wearing in that 81 Fleer card, the Mets wore that same style of jersey in 1986 when they won the World Series. You know, that style brings back good memories for you. And you know, it's always fun when you see teams, you know, reach back into the archives and pull out these jerseys, if not for one special game, maybe one day a week, or you are seeing some that are starting to go back to that look in their general uniform design now. Uniform ethics, uniform designs have become a very big thing over the last 10 or 15 years, maybe a little longer. And you can thank the internet for that. Chris Creamer and the Sports Logo website, which is 20 years old now, reviving the look of a lot of classic logos. And also, Paul Lucas with the Uniwatch blog, first through ESPN. Now he's gone pretty independent with that. And Ice Ethics is another website that looks at hockey logos and sweater designs. So the internet has helped stoke a lot of these memories. So that in hand with some of the older sports cards have really brought that industry back together. And I think it's going to be a fun look. So we're going to do that next Tuesday, 10 a.m. We'll take a look at some classic jerseys and some of my favorites. I'll share why they're my favorites. And I definitely want you to share yours as well. You can even start now if you wish. You've made it this far in the podcast. God bless you. So if you want to, share your favorite uniforms that you either have or you want, uniforms that stick out for Major League Baseball, share them on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.